Good evening. It still feels like summer in this room tonight, although I feel the season turning, don't you? Cooler evenings, still warm days. And just these last couple of mornings, the first time in a couple of months that I have in the early morning wanted to put on a cap. So I know the season is changing. But tonight, maybe it's just all of these layers of clothing, it still feels too warm. I continue to struggle with language, with doing anything with words in this room. And in preparation for this evening, Kathy asked me yesterday morning, I think, how are you doing? And in preparation for giving a talk, I am totally blocked. Oh, and you know, that was not just one little snippet of time yesterday morning. This is several days of, oh no, Wednesday is coming and I'm still totally blocked. So I thought I would share my process with you about being blocked. This question for me of how to verbalize the unverbalizable, how to express in words what is beyond, completely beyond comprehension. And yet, as Katagiri Roshi has spoken it, you have to say something. And so we sit together and try. Somewhere along the line, late yesterday morning, I was reading the ancient teachers, hoping, you know, Catherine said, we should paint across the doorway back there, give up hope, all of you who enter here. Nonetheless, I was hoping that I might draw some inspiration from the ancients. And here's what I found. It is not a surprise that they had some guidance. There is this teaching called Fukan Zazengi. It's basically Zazen instruction. Sit down, put your left leg this way and your right leg this way. Put your hands in this shape, upright posture. And then there's a description of what that posture generates. And it has a line that says, totally blocked in resolute stability. This somehow shifted me out of being stuck blocked into being stable blocked. Very different. You know, I'm certain I'm not the only one who has felt stuck blocked. And it's a completely different sensory experience than being stable blocked. You know? Totally blocked in resolute stability. So I began to work with that internally just yesterday. And also recognizing that in a couple of weeks we have on the calendar here and actually all around the world in this lineage an acknowledgement of Dogen and Kazon as our heritage holders. We are among the branching streams that have come from Dogen and Kazon, let me put it that way. And one of the highlights of Dogen's teaching is this, I can't even call it a thing, this experience that is represented by two words, but that actually is one thing. It's not a thing, but it's one thing. And this is practice realization. Put a hyphen in there. It's one thing. In the conventional way of holding these two words, we would think of them that one is practice and one is realization, and they're distinct, they're different. And Dogen and later his heirs, Kotlun Ejo, on through Keizan Jokin and up to us, continue to try to express this practice realization as one activity. And I would assert that this comes from the root of the experience of being totally blocked in stability. So I'll try to express to you how I'm seeing this. There is a talk in Dogen's writings called Bendowa, and this translates as on the endeavor or on the activity of the way, or another way of translating that is a talk about pursuing the truth. So it's an active engagement with pursuing truth, or being in the way. Not being in somebody's way, but being in the way. Language is tricky. So right within Bendowa, there is something that we recite here. It might be Thursday mornings. Jijuyu Zanmai. And this is sometimes translated as self-employing and receiving samadhi. So in that part of Bendowa, which is a teaching of its own, there is this one paragraph. If practice and realization were two things as it appears to an ordinary person, each could be recognized separately. But what can be met with recognition is not realization itself, because realization is not reached by a deluded mind. Continues, of course. One of the more contemporary translations of that last line by Kaz Ta-Nehisi is not reached with a discriminating mind. Realization is not reached with a discriminating mind. So later in that same teaching, there's a line that says, realization itself is manifested without ceasing for a moment. In talking about Zazen. Each moment of Zazen is equally wholeness of practice, equally wholeness of realization. This is Dogen saying the same thing again and again, repeatedly. Slightly different nuance to each sentence, to each paragraph, but basically it's the same thing again and again. So my internal questioning then became, how would we even know it if realization is present, given that we can't touch it with discriminating mind? And what is it that would know? Or who is it that would know? Without discriminating mind, it seems to me that we have to rely upon the faculties of observation, the sense organs, to check it out and say, is that activity in accord with the way things are or not? And if it is not, what adjustment might I need to make in my behavior to have this activity be in accord? A couple of weeks ago in Humboldt County, when I was there, I offered the precepts to someone, the formal ceremony called Jukai. And I was, in preparation for that, rereading the way Catherine did Jukai. Maybe all teachers do it this way. I don't know. She said something like this. There really is just one precept. Be Buddha. And yet we divide it into 16 so that we recognize that it touches every aspect of our life. So there's one precept, be Buddha. How would we know if that's occurring? You know, we can't know it with discriminating mind. Here's how I would think about it. If our activity is in accord with the way things are, meaning that we're busy being Buddha, we're acknowledging the truth of impermanence, everything changes. We're acknowledging the truth of interconnection. This is no one being or no one thing by itself alone. And we're recognizing the truth of causation, which includes within it the truth of suffering. So, if we are in accord with the way things are, right activity flows naturally. We don't even have to think about it or weigh or evaluate. And sometimes we don't even know what right activity is, so we return to the precepts with some faith. I would call it faith. There's another teaching, the Buddha's Brief Admonitions Sutra, the Parinirvana Brief Admonitions Sutra, that is the last teaching that he gave before dying. And in this teaching, he says, as translated to English, the precepts are the same as my actual presence in the world. So, you know, when we are enacting the precepts, all of them, all 16, including the list of do not, but including the list of taking refuge and returning, when we are enacting these, we are busy being Buddha. It's re-inviting again and again the presence of your own true mind. How do we find our own true mind? So partly, we cultivate and develop a trust, maybe even faith, in the teachings of the Buddha and the many generations of wise women and men who have carried it forward into this time. And, you know, each one of them was informed by their culture and by their time. So when they were teaching to the people who were in front of them in their culture and in their time. One of the amazing gifts of Buddhism is that it continues to adapt itself through us, in us, to the culture and time in which we're living these precepts. It can't be any other way. We can't take somebody else's culture or somebody else's era and make it ours. We're influenced by them, of course. We see that even in the clothing we wear. We're influenced by them. For me personally, wearing this particular set of clothing is for me a way of honoring our ancestry. It's not me trying to be in India, nor in China, nor in Japan, but this is the honoring of our ancestry through time. Mm-hmm. So, people finding their way in their culture, in their place, in their time, includes us. And we're trying to apply these Buddhist teachings to a culture that is very different from the culture of Buddha's time. Mm-hmm. So, that requires of us, this deep and enduring trust that we cultivate requires of us that we fully meet whatever situations we're encountering. And this trust does not come from someone telling us what to do or how to do it or what to believe or how to act. this trust comes from our own direct experience of the teachings and experimenting with applying them to our lives. You know, when on Monday mornings here, we do what we call the ancestors service, and we recite the list of people who came before us, the one list of Daisho, that's almost all men, and one list of Acharya, that is women. And we dedicate our practice to them. And there are certain places where we bow. The priest bows in honor of those, not to ignore all of them, but we bow at some of them in order to express the gratitude for the great gift that they particularly offered. And partly, the bows come approximately every seventh person. It's not planned that way, but that's how they land. And the six that come before the bow are equally honored, you know. Anyway, some of those bows occur at the transitional generations. What happened when this practice moved from India to China? What happened when this practice moved from China to Japan? So we bow at those places, recognizing those people learned somebody else's culture, somebody else's language, somebody else's way in order to bring practice to their culture and their time. To me, that's profound. These are bridge people who... And I would say that this generation of practice were babies in practice in America. This generation of practitioners is that same thing. Future generations may, if we do a good job making this sustainable, look back at, like Catherine's generation, say, oh, that was the pivotal turning of turning this to the Western mind. When we recite these elders, we're expressing a kind of taking refuge with them, not for them, but with them. And this is a willingness to return again and again to practice in the same way that they modeled for us. There's a very persistent mosquito up at this end of the room. Forgive me for... Yes. Yes. They can be annoying. I don't know if you've seen in the Dokusan room, there's a stained glass. You've probably seen it, at least from the outside, right? And on the thumbnail of the left hand of the cosmic mudra in that stained glass, there's a fly etched. Would you like to know the story behind that fly? I'll tell it to you. The artist of that stained glass gave that stained glass to Catherine on purpose, and I'll tell you why. Catherine spent a while at Tassajara, as you know, and she was Shuso there, the head student. One of the duties of the head student at Tassajara is to turn the compost. And we all know that stinky compost brings flies, and well-tended compost doesn't. Apparently, Catherine wasn't very good at turning the compost, and the entire valley filled with flies. And the great memory of that particular season of all of the practitioners, including the artist of that particular stained glass, was spending hours and hours and hours of zazen with flies buzzing their ears and their noses. So he etched a fly on the left thumb of that cosmic mudra in honor of Catherine's tenure as Shuso. This, I would say, I didn't really mean to tell that story, but the mosquito helped. This is an example of practice realization, right? The fly, ordinary life happening even while the compost is doing its thing, the monks are doing their thing, and the flies are just busy being flies. Practice realization right before our eyes. So what were those monks doing? In Dogen's way of speaking it, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Very often that quote is ended right there. And I want to say that's a grave mistake. There are three more sentences. And these three sentences tell a more complete story. If it's the first two alone, I'll say them again. To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. If we leave it right there, we're perpetuating a kind of a sick version of Western materialism or spiritual materialism. So I want to really enunciate the next three sentences because they tell us something about practice realization. The next three sentences. I'll say the whole thing because it has a certain rhythm to it. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. This no trace business is the crux of the matter. How would you know it if realization is present? There's no trace. And yet we know. We've read here a book called Radical Dharma, and Lama Rod in Rod Owens in that book says something like this. Loving oneself in the context of liberation from ignorance creates the capacity for radical presence. So this studying the way to forget the self is true. That's part of it. This is in Lama Rod's way, loving oneself is part of it. And it is in the context of liberation from ignorance. That means all liberation from ignorance. And this creates the capacity for radical presence. This radical presence is what I would say is another way of saying it, perhaps. It's a broader sense of self that's not limited to the conditions, or as many teachers call it, this skin bag. It's a broader sense of self that is quite inclusive. And in many ways, we could say that this is actually a non-self-self. Because it's not limited. We call it ourself, but it's not limited. So this dropping away of body and mind is nothing other than the dropping away of self-centered constructs. What does that actually look like? That sounds so theoretical. What does that actually look like? I would say that this broader sense of self is what actually informs our action. It can be on the social and political realm. It could be in the environmental realm. And it can also be in our small meetings, our board meetings, when they happen. What does it look like? What does it sound like when we're able to not be confined to this small self construct? I brought to share with you some of the Arcata Zen group people have put together a list of core values, and one of them is mutual understanding as part of practice. And the list includes now actual behavior of what mutual understanding looks like when we're in meetings. So I'll read a couple of them to you. I want you to understand that this is my way of expressing practice realization. How do we know that something is realization? We actually don't know until perhaps after the fact we can reflect upon it and see what kind of activity did that bring forth. So it's another way of saying that is the truth of causation. So, what is it that myself in interaction with this set of conditions brings forth? And sorry, I've lost myself in words again. Here are some examples of actual activity of what it sounds like in meetings. Ask questions to understand another's view without critiquing it. Reflect a speaker's view in your own terms and then check with them to see if you spoke it well. Acknowledge and integrate one another's ideas. Help build connections between apparently disparate views. This is the actual activity of practice realization. Because part of what's happening here is recognizing that anyone's small self-view is not separate from and is equally valued with anyone else's point of view. I think we can take that at the social and political level as well. It's much harder to do this on a grand scale because what's actually required to accomplish this kind of practice activity is some level of trust. And in large social settings, we don't necessarily have that kind of trust with each other, so it's hard to get vulnerable and say. But what I think I heard you say is that right? Here's another set of examples. The core value, inclusive solutions as part of practice. So it's not my solution at the expense of yours. It is, oh, I wonder what kind of solution we can come up with together. This activity, be prepared to explain every person's point of view in terms that they can agree represents their thought. So, I'm busy listening to you. Can I explain your argument back to you and have you agree that that's what you meant? I don't have to believe it. I don't have to agree with it. But can I hear it that closely? When consensus seems likely, ask, what have we left out? So, not just including the perspectives of the people in the room, but make it even broader than what this particular group of people can represent. I bring this forward as a way of saying, practice realization occurs with every activity. We actually have a choice as to whether to respond from our conditioned and I would say limited view or from our vow. No, it's even wrong. I'm sorry. It's even wrong to say or. We're responding from a conditioned perspective within the vow. The task is to remember that we're within a vow. And that is an actual example of the absolute, quite broad, inclusive, wide, showing up as the particular activity called you. This is the way it seems to work. Each person chooses within their own capacity, within the context of their own life. Job, family, particular energy level of that day, particular social or political perspective. We each have to choose how to respond. And we return regularly to meditation in order to create this resolute stability. I know for myself, if I try to respond to the world from an unstable place, my activity is unstable. And therefore probably misses the point. But if I'm responding to the world from some resolute stability, it's a little bit more likely that my activity is in accord with the vow. It's not guaranteed, but it's just a little bit more likely. So I'll ask a question and let's have some conversation about it. How does this actually show up in your life? What is it in your life that is actually an expression of this practice realization? We don't know it when we're in it, but retrospectively we have a sense of something that worked or something that didn't work. What is it in your life that is an expression of practice realization? Richard. So the core of what you're communicating there to your imaginary theater students is completely embody what you're doing at any given moment.
No distinction.
Yeah.
Life is
yeah. Yeah. Present completely to the script, to the audience, to what the author intended, to your role. Yeah. Thank you. You might hesitate to say, well, I don't actually know what practice realization is, because it would be as if saying you're realized. And, you know, I know that we can't do that. I know it puts you in an awkward spot. It puts all of us in an awkward spot. But retrospectively, we actually know when something worked and when something didn't work. How do we know when we're off? You can say that if you can't say when you know when you're on. Yes, Kathy.
Well, one of the things I've been thinking about lately is there's a beautiful line in one of the commentaries of the Ordinary Mind is the Way story. That which is happening is the way. It's something that one of the ancestors says. And you're trying to figure out, well, what's the way? Well, that which is happening is the way. And for me, the practice piece is I don't believe that means that we don't take action and that we don't try to influence our lives and the world to increase wholesomeness or to be life-enhancing rather than life-taking. And yet, in any one moment, even if you're planting, you know, wholesome seeds, all that is happening is that which is happening.
Yeah.
And so particularly if I'm in an action mode, can I both take action, but not with some kind of delusion that, oh, this is going to solve it, or this is going to make me happy, or this is the answer. Do it just to do it, I'm doing it because that's what I do. And at this moment, this is the way.
Yes.
So surrendering to that fully and joyfully is a practice realization experience.
Yes. Surrendering fully and joyfully, we could call that liberation, because you're unconstrained in that particular moment, right?
Right.
So this is how we can understand that Buddha's presence in the world is through our own lived experience. That's great. Thank you. Great. So the truth of that is that reality, this is what Dogen meant with the phrase I quoted earlier. Realization itself is manifested without ceasing for a moment. You just expressed it in a contemporary way. Reality is just constantly unfolding reality, whether we are aware of it or not. Yeah? And since we're living out the reality of life, we actualize the reality of life constantly, which includes our tendency to constrict and constrain, and the capacity to be liberated of that constraint. Actualization of reality, or we could say liberation, is only reality expressing itself. There's nothing special about it. Nothing to long for and nothing to gain. Thank you. How do we know? Yes. Yes.
The reality is that you're warm. Is there some sense of trying to adhere to goodness by wearing it, your layers, in warm weather?
I lost one of your phrases. Is there some sense of Yeah, I would be much more comfortable if I were sitting here in shorts and a t-shirt.
Not too bad,
extreme, but... Right? Right. You wouldn't want to see my hairy legs sticking out. But it is like, okay, so I'm warm and I'm sweating. That's all right. You know, make sure I'm hydrated. There's no damage done. It is the higher priority for me is honoring the form of this role. Does that? It's not. It's actually.
The form of permanence, then, your no deviation.
A form of permanence. Say again.
A form of permanence, and there's no grounds for deviation.
I see. You know, it's fabric. It's just clothing. For me, it's an honoring that is not really permanent because it's renewed. It's verbally, for me, renewed every Monday. When we do the ancestor service. Great gratitude. So it would appear to be kind of rigidly holding to a form that might appear to be permanent, but the actual experience is quite fluid. Today, this is what this shows up like. And I can only do this in my Western body. No. So it's like, okay, this human with this set of conditions is meeting this set of conditions in this way at this time. to me, that doesn't feel permanent. It feels responsive. Yeah? There are times when I, well, you're actually looking at me. I'm not rigidly holding to a form because I actually have hair on my head and I've let my, I'm not very good at man grooming. I've let my face grow, right? This is out of form. So this is the conditions of this one on a warm summer day. It's a complex question, Joyce. Thank you. Yes.
Remember Satya Gopi's close friend from Washington?
I do remember, and I hope his hip has healed. Go ahead.
Yeah, just an amazing guy to me. But that was an interesting question because it kind of came up between Satya and Kathy. You might not remember. Well, he was giving a talk, and he doesn't. He has basically not followed the rules of wearing a brown robe, right? Well, he hasn't, anyway. And so the question was, well, what does this mean if I do wear one?
Right.
And he said, it's beautiful. And slowly, that's what you do.
That's right.
I just remember because, I'm saying because that was a moment that precipitated out and meant something to me.
Yeah.
In that interaction.
Yeah. Each person makes their way, right? And for me, the connection, literal warm hand to warm hand. And the sewing teachers from whom I learned, Lanch, and Yoshida Roshi, all the way back through Kodo Sawaki, who resurrected the practice of sewing. This is another lineage of warm hand to warm hand. Another way of honoring this heritage. Pretty simple. So for me, the cost of sitting here sweating is very minor in comparison to the richness of that connection. Mm-hmm. Berenice, I saw your hand. Did you have a question or a comment?
Well, excuse my ignorance for one, because I just started practicing itself, so... when it comes to bowing, I was born and raised Catholic, so in the beginning it felt this. I was being bad,
mm-hmm.
in God's eyes, so to speak.
Yeah.
But the more I sit, the more I do. In my personal experience, it's humbling. It's my way of showing respect for who we all are.
Yes. Yes, that's it.
It's changing.
Yeah. And it would make sense from a different faith tradition, which you, I would imagine, continue to hold in equal esteem. It's perfect. Who are we bowing to and why? You know, there has to be a question. And at the same time, we recognize that this is simply a very human expression of common courtesy in some ways. Yeah. And I know that there's the physicality for me of some expression of heartfelt connection flows when I'm about here in my bow. If I'm too shallow, it doesn't go. And if I go too deep, I've missed it. But right about there in my bow, some flow occurs. It's courtesy, it's an expression of connection. Yeah. And it takes a while to undo many years of past training to actually be able to feel what you're feeling. You're there. Yes, Shakti. Can you speak up, please?
Well,
Yes.
And I don't have a choice, but for me, I try to approximate what everybody else is doing.
Yeah.
Because like you're saying, I want to be part of the flow as much as possible and not a big, like, you know, stopper in the middle of a...
Yes.
So I think, you know, it says something to the whole community to be part of the flow and to try to be within that, those parameters, and to sit and walk and grow and things. And I do it as close as I can to the rest of the community to be part of the flow.
Yes. That's right. That's right. Thank you, Shakti. The forms of practice are in order in a way to underline the fact that we are in community. That's exactly so. And, you know, that you do things what you call differently. It is your wheels and you roll in. And it's not that your intention is any different than anybody else, right? It's like the function of bowing at the door for anyone is, now I'm entering this room. Mm-hmm. When we leave, now I'm leaving this room. I'm conscious of stepping over the threshold. When we approach the seat, now I'm about to occupy this position. Now I'm finished occupying this position, right? It's really putting parenthesis around each and every activity in order to bring our full attention there. In that way, you're doing exactly what everybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. Not an obstacle in any way at all. Thank you, Shakti. It's time for us to enjoy a little tea outdoors. It will be a little cooler out there. Please continue to explore this question of what does practice realization look like and how do you know when it has happened? Also then, how do we know when we're just a little bit off what needs to be adjusted to bring us back to center? Thank you very much for engaging this conversation.